Today's episode of the Film Stage Show is brought to you by Mubi. For your free 30-day trial of Mubi, all you got to do is go to mubi.com/filmstage. Ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. As always, I'm your host, Brian J. Rowan, with me today to talk about the new horror thriller in theaters now, It Comes at Night. We have Bill Graham.
Woo!
We also have Michael Snydell.
Hello!
Hello! We had a guest last week. We do not have one this week, so it's just going to be the three of us again. We are attempting to do more guests. But not
get at us.
Didn't happen right now. Mainly because I am just getting back from vacation, and I swear to God, if we had to do any more logistics while I was gone, I probably would have killed someone. So it's just us. Just us hanging out. You can follow us on Twitter at Film Stage Show. You can find us on Facebook, search for The Film Stage Show. And of course, you can find us on iTunes where you can give us a comment and a rating, which we love, and you can email us podcast@thefilmstage.com. In addition to that, we are brought to you by Mubi, which now has the stellar tagline given to it by us, Mubi, better than sunscreen, because if you're at the beach and you have a pale complexion, sunscreen will protect you for maybe 20 minutes, and you have to keep reapplying it. Whereas if you never leave the house because you keep watching movies on Mubi, you don't have to worry about it at all. You never get sunscreen or sunburned, which unfortunately I did. I should have spent more time on my vacation watching Mubi. Mubi is a curated online cinema that gives you a new film each day that you then have 30 days to enjoy, so you have a constantly rotating selection of 30 great independent, art house, foreign, and all-around wonderful films. All you've got to do to get your free 30-day trial of Mubi is go to mubi.com/filmstage. So if you've got a beach trip coming up, and you have a pale complexion, you have two choices. You could put on some sunscreen and hope to the best, and end up in writhing agony as your skin peels off, or you can download some movies to your phone using the Mubi app and watch those instead. I know which one I'm going to be choosing from now on. Again, that is Mubi, mubi.com/filmstage for your free 30-day trial. Whew. But guys, that's not the only thing we have to plug today, is it?
No, it's not.
Nope. I don't know how to begin this, because, to be frank, it's a weird thing. For 246 review episodes and I don't know how many roundtable episodes we've done, this has been a completely and utterly free show, and we've never asked for money from you, the listening audience. Now, I want to assuage all the worries probably currently coursing through the souls of our fine listeners. We are not putting up a paywall. We are not, like, how did this get made doing, getting rid of our back catalog except to the subscribers of whatever we decide to do. Nope. We are just
throwing shade.
I know, podcasts. I know the things that make podcast listeners wary.
Sure.
And I want to get them out of the way so that when we make this announcement, everyone can react with the joy that I believe it deserves rather than any sense of fear or fear.
Sure.
That they may have. So
trepidation.
So when I tell you that the Film Stage Show is now on Patreon, you will understand that the Film Stage Show and Film Stage Roundtable that you know and love are not changing in any ways. We still will put out an episode every week on a roundtable, hopefully every 2 weeks, though I know we've fallen behind on that. And you will get it for free. The only ad you'll hear is Mubi. We're not going to start throwing in ads for Dollar Shave Club or whatever. Everything
unless
is the
they
same.
Sponsor us.
Unless, yeah, unless sponsor, I mean, us. If they want to sponsor us.
I don't think Dollar Shave Club does podcasts. I do know that Harry's does podcasts, and Harry's,
yes,
is a fine product that we would be happy to have as a sponsor. So I just want everyone to know, nothing is changing. It's all the same. However, we are on Patreon now. We are soliciting Patreon patrons. So the way this is going to work is we've set up our Patreon, and you just have to go to Patreon, that is Patreon.com.
Would they then become Patreons?
No.
Okay.
Sorry. There's a button. It says become a patron. You do not become a Patreon. So you go to that, and then you go to Patreon.com/TheFilmStageShow, and you will come to our page where you can see what we're trying to do. So you can become a patron for as little as $1, and the hope is that we will get enough money to, continue doing this show, only better, because we'll be able to buy better equipment and spend more money going out and seeing movies. Not only that, but if we make enough money, we're going to reward you. So not only is this show not changing in any way that will deteriorate it in your eyes and your hearts, it can only become better. So, for instance, if we make enough money, we will start doing a monthly classic movie. Guys, what do you think our first classic movie should be?
Not It's a Wonderful Life.
Well, you know what? Fuck you, Michael Seidel. I was going to say...
The original Mummy.
That is not a classic movie by any...
Well, no. not the Tom Cruise one. Not the Brendan Fraser one. I would think...
Oh,
like,
the Boris Karloff?
Yeah.
Isn't there a Hammer?
AKA one? The original. Yeah. That's why I said the original.
Anyway, we're not getting into a discussion about what original means or what it doesn't mean. So here's the thing. Now that we've dove into that... So here's what we're talking about. We're talking about being able to do one classic movie a month, a listener chosen review, a movie commentary, and then possibly one non-movie related podcast. And those are going to be in increments of 50. So if we only get enough patrons, damn you, Bill, if we only get enough patrons to get us up to $50, we're still going to do the classic movie podcast. And every time we go up, we'll do another one plus everyone that came before it. So it is possible that by giving us enough money, you could nearly double our workload per month. If that is something that appeals to you. If you are a masochist who wants us to have to do more work. Not only that, but we're going to have special raffles that people can do and get in on to get cool movie swag and free movies. So for instance, Jordan Raup, our benevolent lord and master, is putting up selections from his own personal library for you, the fine folks at home, to win, to take away from him. The first up will be Rumblefish. So everyone who subscribes and becomes a patron and gives us a little bit of money, no matter the amount, again, over $1, you have a chance to win Rumblefish from Jordan Raup. So every time...
That's Coppola, isn't it?
Yeah. And these are his Criterion copies. We're not going to give you, like, dollar bin at Best Buy copies.
Oh, nice.
So Rumblefish is in play. So if you want to be able to have a friend over and point at your Rumblefish DVD, I'm sorry, Blu-ray, and say, hey, man, guess what? I took that from someone by giving money to someone else. This is...
That's generally how commerce works, but yes.
No, I'm not like, but if I give money to Best Buy for a TV, no one walks into Jordan Raup's house and takes his TV.
That would be an interesting way to do commerce, though, wouldn't it? Just all of a sudden you show up to your house and you're missing a flat screen TV. You're like, dang it.
Damn it. I'm going to have to rob sale at Best Buy.
Yeah. I'm going to have to rob Mickey down the street, aren't I?
So there's going to be a bunch of other great stuff that we've got. This is a great, simple way for us to keep doing what we're doing, make more episodes for you, the fine people at home. And in addition to that, we also are talking about opening up a Slack channel for patrons. So if you've ever wanted a chance to yell at us in more real time than Twitter has allowed you to, become a patron and you will be part of a special Slack channel that we will all be on. You've heard us talk about the way that our Slack chats go. If you want to get in on that.
It's crazy. It's crazy.
There are dank memes aplenty. Usually thanks to Bill. There are dumb inside jokes. And I love to react to things with stuff other than a smiley or a thumbs up. So if you've ever wanted to say something to me and have me go crocodile, this is the way to do it. Again, all you got to do. is go to patreon.com/thefilmstageshow. And also check out all of our social media. We'll be posting links. And you can become a patron. You can become one of the Inner Circle. You can steal DVDs and Blu-rays from Jordan Raup. And you can help us to put out even more great episodes. We're going to be talking about this more as time goes on. We'll probably be pimping it fairly regularly. So jump on it. Become one of the first. And be able to tell your friends that you were there when it all began. Patreon.com/thefilmstageshow.
And just as kind of a... you know, pro tip, I guess, maybe the earlier you are, the higher chance that you'll win one of these prizes and things like that. Because as our user base grows, obviously the chances start to dwindle. So, you know, early adopters always get to be rewarded a little bit more this time around.
You damn right. Especially if we get up to the point where you can start. Ooh, we didn't think about this. Where you could start telling us what you want to review. How many Madea movies are we going to have to watch?
Oh, Jesus.
It's okay. There's only as many as the Marvel movies. We're fine. That's
actually a very good point. We'll be okay, hopefully. All right. So again, patreon.com/thefilmstageshow. To get more winning banter, like what we've just had to go through now, all you got to do is go to patreon.com/thefilmstageshow and become a patron today. So thank you, ladies and gentlemen at home, for indulging us in that brief moment of panhandling in the digital sphere. Now we can get into our actual review for today. And that is It Comes at Night, the newest film from writer-director Trey Edward Schultz, the director of Krisha, which, Michael?
Krisha.
One of my favorites from last year, yeah.
Look. It's a miracle that I've stopped calling that movie Krishna. So we should all just be happy that I got that close. Krisha, which came out last year and Michael Snydell really loved. This, as I said, is a thriller horror movie that takes place in the wake of an unspecified apocalypse and finds a family in a house in the woods whose lives are thrown into disarray with the arrival of another family who is looking for aid. This movie stars Joel Edgerton and Riley Keough, and here is the trailer.
I just want to talk. And I want honest answers. Do you have any idea what's going on out there? I'm going to try and help you and your family.
I want to thank you again for letting us stay here.
Just going to run through a few things. When we go out during the day, we like to stick to groups just for safety. The red door. It's the only way in and out of the house. It stays closed and locked all the time. I have the keys. It's the only set.
All right, that is the trailer. For It Comes at Night, the newest film from A24 releasing. My life was thrown into a disarray, I should say, earlier this week, when it came to my attention that for the past however many years, I've been calling it A24. And on Twitter...
Well,
on Twitter, they released a picture of a shirt that said A24, and their tweet was something along the lines of, we're going to keep selling these until everyone gets it right. Now, we have joked in the past about what an A24 fanboy I am. So imagine, if you will, my horror and my dismay at realizing. It's like if you were, like, in love with someone, right? And you're like, I really love Casey. And after 3 years of that, someone pulled you aside and said, bro, her name is Cassie. You just don't know what to think anymore. But this is from A24 Releasing, who we tend to love on this show. And it's from a director that Michael Snydell was eager to see the follow-up work from. And everyone who knows me knows that I love me some Joel Edgerton. So let's... Also, I love post-apocalyptic movies that involve people outside of the actual sphere of destruction who are forced to wrestle with their own inner demons in an enclosed environment. So let's see what we all thought of this movie. Bill Graham, let's start with you.
Yes. Where to begin? Yes, I'm also a fan of post-apocalyptic films. I'm also a big fan of films that try not to explain too much of the reason for the post-apocalypse. You know, films like Mad Max, films like The Road, numerous other attempts in this genre that are just kind of set in the post-apocalypse and then roll with it. I'm a big fan of that because generally when you start to dabble in explaining some of that, it gets a little – it starts to strain the narrative because you're starting to add a element that the post-apocalyptic narrative doesn't really need because – is what it is. It's in the post-apocalypse. It's not during the pre. It's not during the during. It is during the post-apocalypse. So, you know, everything has kind of shattered and we begin from there. So I'm a big fan of those films. This film, I did not realize, involves I don't even know how much I'm really want to get into some of the narratives of what it actually involves. We will just say there is an outbreak that they are trying to contain and keep themselves away from the entire time. The film focuses on kind of the paranoia and the general kind of sense that family is about the only thing that really, really matters. You know, continuing the theme from Fate of the Furious and Guardians of the Galaxy, we got more family, bro. But
this time, film, the families are biological.
True enough. Yes. And the film is extremely well acted. This is I never got around to seeing Krisha, but this film, what I've heard is from him is that this is a very, very personal story, directly relating to his father and things like that. And so I understand that this film is personal. I understand that this film has a lot of mysteries that don't necessarily get answered. And for some people, that's really going to bother them. For some people, they're going to kind of dig that atmosphere and dig everything that happens before kind of the grand conclusion and the finale. I think the film is extremely well made. It is well acted. It is also a frustrating experience because the end peppered my experience so much. And I'm really curious to see how y'all reacted to the film overall and whether the end kind of peppers your conclusions on the film as an experience. I will say that oftentimes I kind of grade against people that do what I'm literally doing now, which is basically say the ending takes away from the rest of the film, but this time I think there's so much that kind of plays into it that I just can't help myself. So,
all right, Michael Snydell, what did you think of It Comes at Night?
Yeah, I kind of think this is an exceptionally crafted whole lot of nothing. You know, I say that as someone who really loved Krisha, and Krisha was something. Tredward Schultz, I'm not sure if you mentioned this already, Bill, but he's actually a regular, I think, second DP for Terrence Malick. Like, he's had a lot of experience being on Malick sets, and his visual sensibility has definitely been informed by that, especially in Krisha, which, you know, even the people who didn't like it thought it was a, you know, really worthwhile, you know, ripoff of Terrence Malick's sensibility and John Cassavetes and things like that. But the thing about this movie is, so one, we're working in a post-apocalyptic milieu, which is, you know, it's well-traveled, to say the least, you know, everything from YA to comedies like This Is the End to, like, you know, like macro sociological studies like Contagion. And I I feel so weird, like, trying to call this film hollow because it is so artfully done, from the art direction to the performances, which seem so, you know, fastidiously calculated, to just the way the script is done. It's this is exactly what I believe he wanted his vision to be. But at the same time, I can't help but think that there are so many, there are all the elements for a story that's far more interesting than what's actually here. And so, you know, I am looking forward to Schultz's career, but this is, for me, an example of a movie that is so pared down and so concerned with this specific vision that there's just no room for it to breathe. And by the time we do start getting into questions of ambiguity, none of those questions had the depth that I was hoping, to even the point where, like Bill, if you do consider the ending as alternative to what it directly could be, the movie even falls apart even more for me. So it is... it'd be one thing if this movie was more straight ahead, but just the fact that there is so much ambiguity there, but then there isn't really anything to support that ambiguity, is what made this an incredibly frustrating experience for me, and just made it feel really familiar and derivative at times, while also reminding me why something like The Witch or It Follows or like this recent crop of art horror really works. So I'm sad to say this one really didn't work for me.
Okay. You both are crazy. This is a great movie. And I don't know, I'm the host, so I say that I win, you lose, and podcast. So, oh man. This is, I'll be frank, a terrible movie to come back to right after, like, and have to do a podcast episode about right after being on vacation. Because I feel like my skills have blunted with the sea air and the bright sun and the sand beneath my toes. But I'm going to do it anyway. So this movie is... I'm not going to address anything that you two said to begin with. And I'm just going to give my thoughts. So this movie is an immaculately crafted, beautifully designed piece of art. Just in terms of its visuals and its pacing. I mean, this house becomes a like real living space that is almost unlike any set that we've seen in movies for quite some time. That it opens up into a big wood around it makes it even more intimidating, and the darkness that inhabits it likewise is intimidating, and I think all that is great. I think that the actors all bring their A game. Joel Edgerton, of course, is fantastic. Christopher Abbott, who plays Will, the patriarch of the other family, is very good. Carmen Ejogo, who plays Joel Edgerton, who plays Paul, who plays his wife Sarah, is fantastic. And Riley Keogh, who I like felt nothing for that I can remember in American Honey, is very affecting here. And then we have Kelvin Harrison Jr., who plays Travis, who is basically the point of view character for this movie. And he is like stellar and spectacular, almost beyond words. And I was about to say something cruel, but just people who don't quite understand what the movie is about, or specifically, why the title is what it is, are like going to be sleeping on everything going on with Travis, and thus probably sleeping on everything going on with Kelvin Harrison Jr., which is a shame, because what he brings to this movie and what he does is just beyond words to describe. Just beyond that, you know, beyond the acting and the visuals, I mean, the tone it strikes is great. The questions it raises and the way in which it modulates between just, you know, the utter horror of this and then the weird lulls that are like make everything sort of okay, and the normalcy is wonderful, and the way it all unspools, the way that it all comes to a head is just so inevitable and heart-wrenching that it's hard to look away from. And after the movie's over, you keep trying to want to find a way that it could have happened differently, but the movie just doesn't allow for that. And it's a powerful, dark statement on humanity's will to survive and what that involves, and ultimately what it gets you, not because of the will itself, but just because of the way that circumstance sometimes works. And then I'll just wrap up by saying the music is really good. The score is fantastic. So that's, yeah, I loved this film. It'll be a good year at the movies if it doesn't end up on my top 10 list. And I was blown away. I went and saw this my last full day on vacation at the beach. And it's a hell of a way to like wrap up your last day of like sun and fun, is to go sit in the dark for like 2 hours and watch this movie. Which is also funny because we were just coming off 2 days of rain wherein I was trapped in a house with my entire, like, well, not my entire family, but a great selection of my family, and things also started to go poorly for us once a dog went missing. So I was like sitting in the theater just like, holy shit, you know, this is like watching Wonder Woman if you just happen to be a soldier in World War One. So yeah, there was a lot of that. But you know, then just on top of it, like, it's I'm glad that we're starting to view the post-apocalypse in different ways than something like World War Z or The Walking Dead does, where we are now allowing ourselves to kind of just be isolated and have to like deal with humanity rather than like most outside threats. I think that this movie,
I mean, to be Brian, you have to say, to be fair, you can say this is a much better version of Walking Dead, but The Walking Dead has absolutely done microscopic stories like this.
Yes, it's treaded in this. It's treaded in this specific territory specifically, yeah, like very, very specifically.
But
yeah,
what I'll say to that is, you know, not to get on a Walking Dead thing, because I haven't seen it in like two seasons, so I don't know what it's doing recently. But I've dipped out because there was an episode called Clear, I believe, where we meet Morgan again for the first time since the premiere.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like one of the best episodes of television that I'd seen in a while. But
yeah, that episode, when we get reintroduced to what's happened to him since, and yeah, we find out his whole history and story. Yeah, that stuff is really, really effective, and that's when The Walking Dead is at its best.
Right,
when it focuses on the micro.
That surrounds that is so overbearingly awful that, like,
sure, no. I'm just saying, Brent, like, you can't say this is new territory, because it is absolutely not.
I'm not saying it's new territory. I'm glad that we're getting back to it and we're recognizing its value.
Okay. Yeah, that's all I wanted to say.
No, this is like, I was just going to say, like, The Road did a lot of what this movie does.
Mm-hmm.
And sure, it had a different angle on it, and I think that the two exist, you know, separately good enough in and of themselves. And I think if it comes down to it, like, you know, Cormac McCarthy still has a darker view of humanity than even this movie
Jesus,
has.
For sure.
Yeah.
Which, you know, if you love Cormac McCarthy like I do, you got to realize, like, yeah, that's pretty much it. He's always going to have the darkest view. But at the same time, just like The Road, with glimmers of hope and understanding of why and how that could be channeled out in a good way. So that's that for my thoughts. It's because we're so focused on the ending of this movie, I feel like it would be a disservice and a waste of time to try to hash out what most of our problems appear to be. Mm-hmm.
My problems are not spoilers only related to the ending at all,
okay,
though.
As if you were able to bring up ones that you had that in no way relate to the ending, and so we can talk about them without talking about the ending, then we'll do that. But the second that we find ourselves having to say we could talk about it later more than once a sentence, we're switching to spoilers. So,
fair enough.
Why don't you lay out one of your issues?
Yeah, I guess one of my issues is that this movie just feels so thin, that these characters are are so dependent on their relationship as just like a father or a mother more than actually who they are. There's so much of this movie that hinges on this idea of like, you know, like defending your family, and like, just none of that interested me. And I just kept being reminded of what a riskier movie would be done, would do, in the sense of, so specifically talking about Kelvin Harrison Jr. I would agree with you, Brian. I think his performance as Travis is fantastic. It's a really fascinating look into the psyche of someone who has never experienced, like, or shouldn't say never experienced traditional society, but it's been so long that they've, that like things like, you know, your normal understanding of people is just so foreign to him and alien. And the way that he embodies that is so great. But like, at the same time, the movie seems to like feign to really be interested in his perspective, but he starts becoming a device. Like, it doesn't, he's not really a character that ends up having any purpose. Like,
I'm curious
every
as to
single
how you see him becoming a device.
I guess that gets into spoilers.
Well, goddamn it.
God
Michael.
Damn it. No, okay. Okay, but the point being that this movie just has no room to breathe. Like, there's never a moment when these characters aren't building. I got really excited really early on where it seemed like things started to go really well for a little while, and I thought they were going to dig into that. Where, shit, I, guys, pause for a second. Did Bill say that there are even two families yet? Have we even said that?
I said it in the beginning.
Because obviously I cut off. So what did you guys say specifically about the plot?
In the intro, I said, you know, a family in the woods who gets thrown into when another family comes looking for help.
Sure. Bill, what did you say anything further?
I didn't say anything more about it.
All right. You know what? Everything I'm saying is edging into spoilers.
Oh, my
God. You win this one, Brian.
Okay. So Michael has now talked himself into a corner where he's realized that I was right. Not about the movie, but just about how quickly we need to get into spoilers. And really, I think that...
I'm sorry, guys. I didn't mean to waste your time.
You know, it's cool. I told you it would happen. It doesn't matter, because this movie... I think people are going to go see it because they're interested in it. I think that the best we can say is, before getting into spoilers to talk about it for people who have seen it, is that, you know, we have a wide range of opinion here, and I find it to be like a thrilling, dark, punishing experience in all the best ways that a movie can be. And Michael, you seem to find it, you know, you said like a whole lot of beautiful nothing. And Bill, like, you obviously have some issues with the ending. And I think that, you know, the kind of people who listen to this show will probably hear all that. And it would be, they're going to want to see this movie now more than they would probably want to see something that we were all totally.
Since we're all over the place on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So we're going to leave you with that. If you haven't seen the movie, turn off your podcast and go out and see it. I say don't see it. Some of the other people may say. But my, you know, like I said, I'm the host. I win. So, let's get into spoilers. So, Michael,
a lot of ground to cover.
Yeah, should I do the thing I do where I just kind of run
Please.
Through everything? Okay.
Please.
So Will, who is again played by Christopher Abbott, shows up in their house and he is subdued by the family. Paul, played by Joel Edgerton, you know, questions him and thinks he's fine. And they decide that rather than like bartering for food and water, they should just merge their familial units. Will and his family have chickens and goats, and so they can use them for food. And so they do. Paul goes and checks out Will's family and clears them. They're not sick. They come home and everything is going fine. And everyone's happy. They're playing Chinese checkers. They're having family dinners. And, you know, Travis is getting a little bit of a crush on Kim. And Travis just seems to, like, enjoy, like, seeing this other family there. Like, they have a young son.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And everyone's kind of having a good time. And then one day, Stanley, the family dog, escapes and runs into the woods. Travis runs off after him. And Will catches up with Travis. And then Paul catches up with both of them. There's a lot of shouting. They go into the house. They're going to look for Stanley in the morning. But morning for Stanley never comes. Instead, later that night, the red door that functions as like the kind of airlock into their house is left ajar, and Stanley winds up in the room between that red door and the actual outside, and he is bloody and broken. And then the question arises, who left the door open? How did Stanley get in there? What the hell happened? Earlier that night, Travis had seen Andrew, the young son, sleeping in his grandfather's room. So Andrew can't remember what the hell he did. So there's a question as to whether or not this young child sleepwalks. So the decision is made. The two families are going to section each other off and just kind of like wait a day and see what happens. See if anyone's sick. See what's going on. This actually, from my eyes, was like great because I was expecting like bullets to start flying immediately. But I was like,
sure.
Oh, that is a super logical thing to do. Good work, Paul, played by Joel Edgerton, like coming up with that, and it seems to work for everyone. Until Travis hears Will and Kim fighting and like having a big conversation and Andrew crying, and he's like, oh my god, I think that Andrew's sick and I think that they're like planning on leaving. So that's
it should be mentioned, a little kind of nice detail is that Travis has, I guess he's going upstairs into the finished attic. I'm not sure quite where he's going, but he basically goes into a location throughout the film where he can kind of spy slash hear on people. And so he does this just as kind of a way to pass time. I think he's kind of feeling anxious because in a way he's kind of kick-started this entire kind of sequence of events of no fault of his own, but basically he is the one that discovers Andrew. He is the one that discovers the dog. He is the one that remembers that small little detail about the door being open, and that door specifically from the inside is never supposed to be unlocked unless someone is specifically going in or out, and that's about it.
And also, I was about to just be incorrect about that. He's been having a series of like dreams and nightmares ever since. I mean, for as long as he can remember, seemingly. And so he's constantly awake at night. But so Paul and Sarah go to check on Will and Kim and Andrew, and they got their gas masks on because they're fairly certain that Andrew's sick. And this is when things take a turn. Will has kept a gun in secret and, you know, uses it to subdue Paul for a moment. They're going to leave. They're going to take some supplies and water. But the family doesn't want them to go because they surmise that if they leave and then they don't find a better place to go, they will just come back and try to take more. Or other people will use them to try to come and take more. And so everything that could go wrong goes wrong. Basically, the movie ends with Will nearly beating Paul to death. Will getting killed. Kim and Andrew running away, and Paul attempting to shoot Kim and accidentally killing Andrew. He then kills Kim because she's just screaming and crying. And then it turns out that Travis has been sick and has been made sick and dies. And the final image of the movie is Paul and Sarah sitting at a kitchen table that had once been filled with so many people, just with themselves, looking at one another.
Seemingly sick themselves, it appears.
It's either sick or just sick with worry. So that's how the movie ends. It is not a happy ending. I don't know if people could have seen that coming. So that's the basics of it, so we don't have to talk plot details that are that large, but we can get into smaller ones as we go through this. So Michael Snydell, why don't you kick us off? You had tried to do this pre-spoilers. It did not work. So let's give you another shot. What are some of your issues with this movie that make you feel as though it was... What did you say it was? It was a whole lot of nothing?
Yeah, no, it's a spectacularly crafted husk. All right, so let's start with Travis and the structure of the movie. So as you were talking about, Brian, it's kind of these episodic nightmare sequences that were kind of inured right at the beginning, that they are going to happen essentially every time when it seems like he's maybe about to go to bed. Like at least at the beginning, we're getting a pattern for these nightmares, and then that becomes, you know, more tangled to make us wonder, you know, when he's in a dream within a dream, or when he is awake, or, you know, what reality actually looks like. And it's the beginning of that that is just kind of my problem with the film, in the sense that, like, it's not only that pattern, but just that rigid ambiguity that is very annoying and not very rewarding, because it's not like those nightmare sequences added anything. They were beautifully shot. They're generally tracking shots where you have the score from Brian McComber. You know, it kind of like oscillates between these, like, you know, sweeping trills and these, you know, droning, you know, like droning, sawing strings, like something out of The Witch or Under the Skin, or, you know, like almost any serious in air quotes, like art horror film. Like, it's become like the du jour of the moment. And like the first time that happened, I was like, all right, this is exactly what it's advertised. And just throughout the film, like, this heat hits every beat exactly when you expect it to. There's a moment right at the beginning where they are burning the grandpa, and it starts panning up. And I was saying in my head, or I should say I was screaming in my head, do not show me the title screen right now. And like, that is the thing. Like, every single, if you have seen any movie that is within the realm of, again, art house horror in the past, I don't know, 8 to 10 years, you are going to guess every beat here. But like, the thing is, there aren't like weird detours here. Like, I think of like Martha Marcy May Marlene, like another movie that has like these pretensions to be about way bigger ideas, but it has random things like John Hawks, like, you know, writing folk songs, or like, you know, there are these moments that give you a glimpse outside of the world. And this is so insular, and that, I'm not saying that's not what he didn't want it to be, but there's never a moment where this feels like anything more than an exercise to me. Like, and these characters never pop outside of like their preordained roles to like be paranoid about each other. And even that paranoia is so limited. It's based entirely in plot points. Like, and like even the most concrete example we get of paranoia, like about halfway through the movie, is where we find out that Will's character, played by Christopher Abbott, is that correct, guys?
Correct.
Yes. Will's character, played by Christopher Abbott, potentially lied about having a brother and then changes it to brother-in-law. Like, it's that detail, which is in an interesting way not resolved, is like a concrete example of paranoia. But like, everything is just so rushed and on just like on a timer from when everything was happening. And it just really bothered me. And then once we then go from this very straight ahead, very schematic script into something that wants to be more dreamy and out there, and then make you question whether anything actually happened, it just left an incredibly sour taste in my mouth. Like, that's the thing about this that Krisha didn't have, is Krisha had that swirling immersion, but you were constantly aware that that was her own subjective view. So the movie didn't feel as like punishingly small because you were constantly aware that's only her perspective. And this movie is just, it's constantly a compromise between something much weirder and a very traditional post-apocalyptic narrative.
Okay, well, I don't know how much I agree with the idea that this is like a compressed narrative and that's an issue. That is what this film is. You know, they do a really good job of kind of not detailing how people get sick and why people get sick. We see them with the gloves. We see them with the mask, but we don't even know necessarily that that's an actual failsafe, that that's actually going to do anything. We don't know how this disease spreads. And it should be noted that we haven't really named it. We haven't really talked about it in specifics, but it seems to be a plague of some sort. And it's not necessarily I thought this film was going to, from the opening images, I thought it was going to basically kind of be a zombie narrative, but it turns into more of a bubonic plague kind of situation. And, you know, modern technology and things like that, we've kind of started to realize how to keep that at bay, at least for a little while. Obviously, this family and the people around them aren't necessarily all that successful at it. But it builds and builds this paranoia that basically we don't know what the fuck is going on. And anytime we interact with somebody outside of our immediate circle, we don't have a clue if they're hibernating or if they have some kind of hibernating disease or if they are carriers already. There's a masterful scene where Will basically gets tied up outside and he is yelling from dawn till dusk, basically, and just being like, what? Why am I here? This sucks. This is terrible. I do not have any disease. I don't know why I'm being treated like this. And of course, you know, Paul and the family is just like, no, like, this makes sense.
Well,
like,
the great thing is that when, you know, at least when Paul and Will are talking to each other, Will, still tied to a tree, says, like, I have no bad blood with you. Like, I understand what you've done and why you've done it. You have to understand that I'm doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah.
And that's one of the things about this movie is that, like, again, I don't know if this is still an issue with The Walking Dead, but it seems like in that show and other shows that deal, or shows or TV shows, there are movies that deal with, like, the post-apocalypse, there's people who, like, just have a very, like, messed up sense of morality, and they're like, why did you treat me so poorly? And then they'll turn around and treat someone exactly as poorly with, like, no sense of, like, self-examination. And so it's nice that in this movie, these two characters appear to have, like, very similar concepts and ideas about, like, what is fair and just when this is what's on the line.
And so, you know, based on that whole idea and that setup and the execution of it, I think the paranoia and the idea that this film isn't going to kind of rest on its laurels, I'm not quite sure what you wanted, Mike, because I don't know if you wanted some happier times just to get happier times. We get that a little bit because we get the Chinese checkers scene. We get some of these other sequences, but there is going to be a paranoia because, like Paul tells Travis in kind of the middle of the film, when the two families are seemingly kind of settling in with each other, he basically tells them, look, I don't care how familiar we get with them. I don't care how, you know, relaxed it kind of seems. You need to stay on your toes because we're the only ones that are family, and family is the only thing that's going to kind of keep us together.
Ones who they really know who they are.
You know? Exactly. Yeah. They've spent enough time with each other to kind of know, okay, you're not a bad person, at least not yet.
Not even that. It's just like we were saying, when Will says, I have a brother that we stayed with and he's dead now, it's like he might have not had a brother ever.
Sure.
But like, yeah. if Travis were to say to Paul, his father, you know, I had a sister, it's like, no, you didn't. I'm your goddamn father. Like, I know everything about you. You know everything about me. Like, we have the kind of trust that is only gained by utter knowledge of one another, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which gives the nightmares that Travis has and the interiority of his life that he kind of keeps from everyone else. I mean, A, that's the thing that, like, a teenager will do. And B, it's what gives, like, another level to that, because Travis is on the brink of becoming his own person with his own secrets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so I'm just not quite sure what Mike wanted from this film to do specifically in that regard. And, you know, the setup and the execution, like I said, I think the paranoia is played off, and it's played off well. And I think it's deserved, because there is, like I mentioned, there's a lot of mystery around what the hell is even going on. And I think part of it is narrative convenience, but part of it is because more than likely we don't know what's going on. We don't have a bunch of scientists that are kind of at the heart and experimenting with these people. They're burning bodies pretty much once they get infected. And it's like, okay, so you don't know what the hell's going on, because I would think burning a body that has a plague on it, probably not the best idea either.
I didn't see a problem with that. I mean, if it's a bloodborne plague and you burn the body, then you're killing the pathogen. I mean, like, but that actually brings up another thing, is that, like, the hostility or the uncertainty in this movie begins early on when, again, you know, because another thing this movie does, by the way, is great diversity in casting that never goes comments mm-hmm. upon, and very well-rounded characters. So, like, Paul and Sarah, you know, Sarah's not Lady Macbeth, Paul's not, you know, overbearing dad from American Beauty. Like, they are all working towards a common goal and have equal parts hope and, like, reservation in them. So, like, she says, after he's talked to Will, she says, like, did he mention, like, seeing the smoke from you burning, you know, my father who just passed away? And Paul says, no, why? And she's like, well, that's probably how he found this house. And so that should set up the concept of, so he's lying when he says that he thought no one was in the house.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
at least it's giving you at least some kind of doubt, right?
Right. But and so the movie asks a lot of that. Like, how much are you willing to let slide for the appearance of normalcy and being able to find a community or a concept that you thought was gone forever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're willing to give up a certain amount of what you know to be true, or you're willing to let a certain amount of niggling little questions go. But when you hit a certain point, it becomes harder to do that. And that's the point when, you know, Will incorrectly says that he doesn't have a brother, or, you know, that he misspoke earlier about if it was his brother or if it was his brother-in-law. And that's the point where, you know, Paul doesn't even bother to go try to ask the wife, because he's like, well, we just know now that this, like, small moment that we've had, you know, probably can't happen again, because there's just going to be too many unanswered questions and too much mistrust. But we can still work together as a unit to keep each other alive up until the mm-hmm. point that, you know, your inability to... I mean, this is the question that really drives the end of the movie, is whether you think that Andrew was infected or not. But I mean, at the end, the even bigger statement and the reason that I like this movie is that it doesn't really matter if he was infected or not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could fight and you could, like, do the Reddit thing and go through every frame of this and say,
there's,
like,
also a question whether that last thing is actually a dream or not as well. There could be someone who could argue that.
I guess, oh, but I really don't
a little
see
bit,
a
but.
Dream.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure how much of that last sequence that you're even talking about.
Because we see the last thing we see before the purported end is Travis going through multiple dream sequences. Like, it's the end of this movie is so concerned with just trying to make it more fuzzy, but not for any reason other than I'm sorry. I do not think these are fully formed characters. I don't think this is a well-written movie. Like, we are going to fundamentally disagree here. I think these are great actors.
I don't know what that has to do with what we're talking about right now, though.
Well,
it absolutely is, because it has to do with the fact that I don't think this movie does anything new or interesting with any of these dynamics you guys are talking about. So the very fact is, like, you guys really cared about these characters.
Yeah.
And I couldn't remember two of the characters' names by the end of the movie. And well, that's my own
that's
problem.
That's just Bill Graham disease. Wait,
yeah.
That is my own problem. But I say that as a point to say that I don't think that these characters are so calculated for the script's particular purpose, but I don't think that makes this a good movie. And I think there's a difference between atmospheric claustrophobia and over-direction. And I think this is absolutely guilty of over-direction and stretching out a story that can't support it. The very fact that this is like an hour and 37 minutes. Oh shit. I really am turning into Bill. It is like, it limped to the finish line.
I disagree.
Like, this
100%.
Movie feels so, it feels so stretched out. And like the dream sequences feel like gimmicks to me. Oh, the, man.
Right.
Guys,
like,
I guess we're just going to disagree on this one, but don't fucking say that I don't understand the movie. Like, the very fact that you said that before we got into spoilers,
I wasn't talking about you specifically, though. I was going to say, like, people who walk in.
The implication that there is, like, some greater meaning here is just, like, okay, but that's also, like, this bullshit pseudo-intellectualism that this movie also peddles in. Like, I really don't think this movie has anything interesting to say. I thought Contagion did these ideas way better actually trying way more angles.
Insanity
I thought
to me.
Something like I Am Legend did the exact same thing as this. It didn't have the relationship. It didn't have the couple dynamic. But I don't. Oh, God, I guess this movie pissed me off for some reason.
I was about to say, like, I've been where you are right now, and it's not a fun place to be, and I apologize. But
I fucking loved this guy's first movie, and this movie irritated me to no end.
I haven't seen Krisha, as, you know, evidenced by the fact that I didn't even pronounce his name correctly. But, like, this movie is, I just don't understand, like, this. This movie felt swift and fleet and, like, lean and mean to me. Like, everything...
Yeah,
like,
lean and mean, but, like, lean to the point where there's nothing there.
But you just But you just said that it's stretched, like, a nothing story. But how can you say it's... I guess I don't understand how
it
that
can't
works.
Too lean? I don't quite understand what you
but
mean.
But I'm saying... You said it limped to the finish line, and I'm calling it, like, lean and mean, and you backed me up on the lean part, but I guess you mean like it's lean like a, oh man, I don't know.
It's a husk. That's what he said. That's what he said.
Okay.
Yeah, it's lean in the sense that there's not any meat there, but it.
I just don't like
again,
don't...
but it's also still so well crafted. That's the thing. That's why I think this movie is getting a free pass. Is that. Shit, now I'm getting into shitty, specious territory. That's not what I'm trying to do.
Quit painting yourself in a corner. We'll talk. Yeah. We'll talk.
All right.
Okay.
I'm going to go sit in the corner.
So, okay. So what I'll say is that I found the leanness, which I'm saying in a good way, of this movie to be refreshing. I liked that there weren't, like, you know, there's like a brief conversation about, like, so what did you do before all this? But that's the conversation that leads to some actual things. There wasn't like that whole like, so what did you do before the world went crazy, and someone's like, oh, you know, I was a cook, and then later on, like, they have to save the world by baking something, you know, like it's the way that most conversations.
I want to see that movie.
I don't know, I want to write it now though. So like, but it's the way that, like, a lot of these interactions and conversations, like, they come to nothing because that's how most interactions are, but then you kind of begin to comb through them. Like, if Stanley hadn't shown up and that door wasn't open, Travis probably never would have remembered or, like, ever brought up the fact that he saw Andrew sleeping in another room. And it's just simple things like that that really make this, I think, like, a good movie and something that's very interesting. The way that... like space is explored, the way that like people have their private places, but you know, because you're in this old house, like nothing is really private. But luckily it's only Travis who's like going around and looking at these things, and he's been doing it for a while and it's never come up, but finally it does. And it's like you've seeded the idea that Travis is the type of guy who would follow up and go looking, and he's curious and he has an interest in this woman, you know. And it's never like overblown or like crazy. Like he has one vaguely erotic dream about her that obviously sure. goes to shit.
A very wet dream.
Well,
that's
like,
disgusting, but correct.
let's be honest. Like Travis more than likely has not spent time with sure. another female that isn't also his mom, probably in, I don't know, a year or two. So his attraction to Kim yep. in that way is just like, you're a female and you are attractive, and yep. I don't know who you are.
Well, what's so, that's what I was trying to say. He's almost alien. Like there's an yeah. alienness to his interactions with Kim.
Beyond your normal gawky teenager. He's got a whole lot of other shit he has to work through. And he just lost his grandfather. And but I think Michael.
And his fucking dog.
Yeah, well, yeah, the dog happens too. But
because of course they kill the dog because it's a horror movie. So why can a dog ever live?
When we moved into my house, I told my wife, I was like, we gotta watch the dogs closely, because if they start barking in the middle of the night for no reason or like stare at a corner of the yard, we're moving. Because I'm not going to be that guy who's like, what's wrong with Bandit? And then like 30 minutes later, Bandit's hanging from a tree and it's like, oh no, some neighborhood kids must have done this. Like, no, there's a ghost in your goddamn house. Anyway, that's just my dog rant, I guess. So, but what I'll say is, like, Michael, what you're talking about in this movie, like, I was expecting, like, Travis's attraction to Kim to, like, really go somewhere. And it doesn't, and that's great. Like, that's...
No, I don't want it to go somewhere. That's not what I'm, that's not
like,
what
you,
I'm saying.
You keep saying, like, there's, like, things that happen and nothing matters. And, like, you know, these people don't go anywhere and the relationships don't really come to anything. And then you said that, like, you could kind of call the shots that the movie was doing. And I feel like, you know, if you're going to call a shot for anything, you'd assume that, like, just this attraction to Kim would, like, result in something. Or, like, he would pull an atonement.
No, but
where...
it's very much like a schematic of, like, indie movie, of an independent movie, though. Like, I knew that wasn't gonna actually go somewhere more lurid or pulpy, because there's no part of this movie that's lurid or pulpy or would ever become not serious enough to become like that. This whole movie is so, like, concerned with, like, following this very specific
But, like, in The Witch, that kind of thing does happen.
I know, and that's why I think The Witch is a way better movie.
But you were comparing this derogatorily, saying, like, it's the same vein, it's doing the same things.
No, but it is very much in the schematic of something, like, of, like, recent crops of art horror, like Under the Skin, like The Witch, like The Babadook, like It Follows, or even things that, like, or even Eyes of My Mother, which I really fucking hated. But the point being that, like, there is an austerity to all of these movies that is, like, its thesis statement. Like, the visual, the art direction and the camera movement here, like, calls back to masters in the same way that The Witch did. Like, The Witch was Kubrick, It Follows was John Carpenter. Yet, you know, like, all of these are very much genuflecting at very specific, like, aesthetic visions. And this is one where that completely fell apart to me, and it became only that aesthetic vision. That became something that was impossible to look past for me, because, and then by the very fact that you have this movie that wants to tell a very straight narrative, and then, but still also wants to traffic in this dream imagery. Like,
I really don't understand your fucking issue with the dreams. Like,
yeah, because what's your
sticking point for you is becoming a thing for me.
Yeah. Well, it's
becoming
it's
sticking
weird.
Point for you.
Yeah, it's, your it's, sticking point sticking my point, you son of a bitch.
It's
Bill,
weird
you
because it's weird because what you're saying, Michael, is that this film is way too self-serious, way too self-serious. And then you're like, and then it's got this goofy dream shit.
I'm not saying it's goofy at all. That's not – I never used the word goofy.
I understand that you didn't say goofy. But what I'm saying is that you're saying this film is way too self-serious. And then you're like, and then it's got this dream shit.
That is still about like – art house ambiguity. It's still about like,
but that's pulpy, isn't it?
No, it's not. No. There's no way that ambiguity is pulpy. Like there, you might be able to come
up with
ambiguity.
Like, no.
There's ambiguity here. Like you're questioning the whole end of this film, and I'm like, I don't question the whole end of this film at all.
You're gonna tell me that final shot. This uniform shot of them across the table that then goes right to black is an art house.
That's
not an art house horror move.
Right? I don't understand how we jump to that sequence.
I don't understand. Well,
you said the end of the film.
Well, to Mike, you know, just to, I don't. Why does that have to be an art house horror movie? Like, is it because that it's symmetrical? Like, I don't understand what the problem is. I guess is my issue here. Like, you seem to be angry at art house horror films, which is fine.
I generally like art house horror films. That's what I was trying to communicate.
Right, but you're taking this one to task for being one
because it is now a house style. It's not the same argument, but it's comparable to something like what we get into when we talk about Marvel.
Whoa.
And that's not this fucking movie's fault, though.
I don't find that to be true at all.
All right, do you guys want me to go on?
Go ahead. Go ahead.
I just, like, you brought up Marvel, so we all had to freak out for a second. Please go
ahead. I know that's literally the most vulgar thing I could say possible.
I also just want to point out that Bill didn't like this movie either. And he, for some reason, is standing next to me against you.
Hold on. I never said I didn't like this movie.
You have an issue with the ending.
Yes.
Yes.
Which we haven't gotten to yet.
Well,
let's just jump to the ending, then.
Let Bill talk about his thing with the ending, and we'll see if it wraps in with yours. And then I can valiantly defend, and then we can go our separate ways.
Sure.
And live our independent lives, free of plague. All right, so Bill.
This is a good last episode of the Film Stage Show, guys. I'm glad we started the Patreon.
Take down the Patreon page. This is never happening again. Bill Graham.
Get Snidell off the podcast.
What was your problem with the ending, Bill Graham?
Okay. So my biggest issue is this film is not following – this film is not an adaptation, right? So this is why can't I remember his name? Trey Edward Schultz. This is his whole creation. This is made from his brain, right? As the famous Scott Pilgrim line goes, where'd you get that? My brain. So this is his creation, and he is building in ambiguity about the ending, about what happened with the door, who brought the dog in, because if I remember correctly, and y'all can either back me up or tell me I'm wrong, and unfortunately we don't have a spouse here to kind of give us a yay or nay, but there is most definitely a broken window and glass on the ground. When we see that final dog, right?
I believe that final dog. Yes, I do believe that is the way that is composed. That the dog has somehow been thrust through the window.
So what the fuck is going on here? I don't understand what the fuck is going on here, because they don't deal with that outside issue. Instead, what they do is they continue to point the fingers internally instead of saying, hey, how the hell did this dog get thrown into the building? Why would someone in this family do this? Why would any of these sequences occur? And instead, the film gives us this very, very convenient kind of reason to start pointing the fingers. I think it is a much better film if we just find that door fucking open. Maybe the dog is retrieved. Maybe the dog is not retrieved. But we don't have to have this kind of other extra mystery on top of another extra mystery. So, I think it would be so much more interesting if maybe a inside door was left open. Maybe it was knocking around. Maybe it was making noise for Travis to then discover that the interior red door, the secondary door, is actually open, or something along those lines, or even not have that as the central mystery towards the end that propels this narrative forward, because I think all we have to have is generally Andrew to be sick and them to kind of separate a little bit and start arguing with each other, and then that will drive the narrative forward. I think we can find a more convenient, a more interesting thing that isn't just completely ambiguous and just driving me up the wall with all of these questions about what is going on and why anybody's ulterior motives would be to deliver the dog, sick as it is, to the family in the way that they did it, and then also leave the fucking door open. Like, none of that makes a lick of sense to me, and it just screams ambiguity for the sake of just ambiguity, for sake of the narrative, in a way.
I just want to be clear. You don't mind the ending with the various people dying?
No, not really.
Okay. I don't have a problem with, like, the machinations of that after, like, the point. It's basically, like, your main problem is
that the set off to
there's a lingering question of why that dog was in that room, and they don't really address it, and you don't like that they even have that there at all.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah,
I found that a little thrilling because I like that
there is this question of that there might be other something supernatural kind of going on, because like the dreams that Travis has, and his claim that like the dog disappeared into the air and that there's people like up there. But you know, the film does this stupid thing where they're like, yeah, the dog like might have disappeared into the air, and like Travis is looking straight up, and what does the film do? It focuses like at eye level onto this tree with like these massive like scratches into it. And you're like, why don't you pan up, film? Like, why don't you ever pan up? Because there's nothing up there. Like, duh, there's not going to be anything up there that the other characters don't see as well.
That's weird, because I didn't think that the camera wasn't looking at what he was looking at.
No, it's definitely like eye level and looking at a tree that has like a bunch of scratches, because
that's what he was looking at. He seemed to be staring off into the woods up a slight incline, and that's what it was looking at. Now, for me, it was interesting because if we were dealing with a basic, you know, art house horror film, as Michael Snydell brought up, what it feels like to me would happen is the question of the dog would become the ultimate question, and
sure, you
know, the families would start fighting because, you know, the original family, the family headed up by Paul, would say, you know, for all we know, you know, Will and them like found the dog and killed it just, you know, to fuck with us, or, you know, there'd be like an exterior threat of some kind, and it would make them turn against each other because of mistrust regarding the integrity of their defenses. Now, instead, what happens is the second that Travis says that the inner door was open, the questions about why the dog ran off, what happened to the dog, why the dog was delivered, all disappear, because none of that is as important as, is now anyone sick?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what drives the rest of the movie, because it's possible that we don't really know what happens when a person becomes sick. They don't die that we've seen. We saw Paul shoot their grandfather in the head. And Travis is continuously having dreams wherein the people in a much more advanced state than his grandfather are there, including his grandfather. So it is possible that these people become, you know, oil-spewing zombies at some point. We don't know for sure.
Yeah.
All that we know is that this is a death sentence. It is communicable. And so whether or not the, you know, because we even see Travis at some point drawing a picture of like dark figures out in the woods, it becomes like a moot point, because it doesn't matter if there's an outside force that's coming to kill you. If the body isn't whole, then you're not going to survive anyway.
Sure.
And so their answer is, okay, leaving aside, like, let's leave aside the door opening, the dog being there, like every single thing that should be the focus suddenly disappears. And they say, what we're going to do is we're going to not see each other for a day. It'll help us to cool down, and it will also let us know if anyone is sick and we won't infect one another. And that's what happens. Like, mm-hmm. So when they're sitting at that table at the end of the movie, it is devastating, because like there's still that question lingering. And on top of that, this idea that they had to kind of very diplomatically cool down and see what happens only led to more problems and
sure.
more deaths.
Because then there's that central mystery of what's going on over there, right?
Yeah, like let's not forget because, the fact that there's still some shit out there.
Sure. Yeah. You know, I don't know. Like, I just feel like there is an unambiguous or maybe a slightly less frustrating way to kind of wrap up and set off that particular narrative and that particular idea. Because you're right. What I ended up focusing on is what the hell happened to that dog and why the hell was it delivered in that way? That seems like such a dumb way to do all of these sequence of events. And you know, it's like, okay, so maybe the one or two of these kids are sleepwalking, right? But as Kim mentions, that immediately rules out Andrew, because Andrew can't even reach the fucking locks. Like, he's not tall enough to. So he couldn't have possibly unlocked the door from the inside. So it ends up kind of pointing the finger at Travis, and Travis is ultimately the one that ends up getting sick. There is a question of whether Andrew was sick, because the father weirdly wants Andrew to cover his eyes the entire time while he's like sticking up Will, which doesn't – or sticking up Paul, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense, because it's like we're in an intense situation. Covering your eyes is not going to make it any less intense. It's going to –
I guess there's as a father, I get to say that now. It's fun. I think that, like, you know, hearing a gunshot and someone hitting the floor is probably going to be a lot less traumatic to a child than seeing that person get shot.
Yeah, but that wasn't the immediate threat, right?
Right, no.
Will wasn't saying, I'm about to shoot this dude. I need you to cover your eyes. Instead, he was like, keep your eyes closed the entire time while this whole situation is going down.
Well,
and
kind of
I feel
is-
like. Like one of the markers of the sickness is that you can see the infection in someone's eyes, because we see mm-hmm. that when Travis is staring in the mirror and he's got like a little flick in like the edge of his iris, or
he's got the Rick and Morty
pupil.
Eyes.
Yeah. So perfect. So you know, it's one of those situations where I think, you know, they think they can protect Andrew by basically getting the hell out of there and saying, you know, he might be sick, but just let us leave, which is
this is what I'm concerned about happening. And it's sort of happening, but it's also still something super interesting to talk about in this movie. I think at the end of the day, you could go back and forth forever on who did what at what point and who got sick and who got who else sick, because
sure.
And I'm going to do it very quickly, even though I just said I didn't want to do it. Let's say that Travis has been sleepwalking, which is possible because he's having these nightmares and these dreams, and he goes for walks at night and all this other stuff happens and it's fine. So let's say that he's doing that. Let's say that like the stress and everything and his, you know, budding sexuality is making him have a parasomnial disorder. Let's say he goes and he opens the door, because to him that door is keeping the world out, and what he wants more than anything is to be in the world. Fine. Now, was the dog already in there? So did he get sick? Did he then get Andrew sick because he brought him to his room? Or did he open the door, go back to bed? Did he then hear Andrew, who was also walking around doing stuff because he couldn't sleep and he was scared, who'd already gotten sick by the dog, and so he got sick from Andrew? It doesn't really matter in the end who got who sick. It doesn't matter if Andrew was sick, though it, to my mind, seems like Andrew was sick because of the covering of the eyes and because on the stairs the father said, "We just want enough, like, we just want what's fair enough for the both of us." And that seems to me in my mind like he was saying, "My wife and I," because I'm pretty sure my son is about to die. But he just doesn't want to be in that house. He doesn't want to deal with it. And also because he knows that if his son is sick, then they're going to assume that they're sick and they're all going to be murdered. So that's fine. It's great. But it doesn't really matter in the end, because what the movie is saying is, like, you can do everything right and you can respond in a reasonable way, but things will still spiral out of your control and there will always be an element that you can't deal with. And in the end, it's that fact that's going to doom you. And then the idea of control
is ultimately what kind of dooms you is that you proceed forward under the assumption that if I do things right, then I will get the outcome that I deserve or that I want.
Right. Like if they had just if it, rather than being proactive, they had said, like, let's not worry about Will and his family. Let's just stay in our room. Will and Kim may have found a way out and they may have gone off into the woods and died and everyone would still be fine. Or, you know, at the end of the day, Travis might have died because he was sick. It doesn't matter because it's out there and you're doing all these things that you hope will save you, but sometimes you can't. And that's what makes that, like, kind of final image so harrowing, is that this mother and this father are sitting across the table from each other after just having killed three people and then having to lose their own son. And then the question becomes, like, well, what now? Like, we were fighting to preserve this order. There's still the two of us, and we are... I assume that they are fine, but you don't know. And, like, do you keep going on because maybe the next time it'll work out? Or do you, like, change up what you're doing? Because you seemed like you had everything pretty well in hand, but it still didn't work. And so that's where the movie... Like, spoilers for The Road, I guess. The Road is all about a father trying to keep his son safe and kind of losing his humanity in the process. And so in order for the son to be taken into a better place, the father has to die after having got him there. But this other family that is the son's salvation won't approach until the father is dead, because they know that his drive to save his son is greater than whatever impulse towards altruism or community he had. And that's dark as shit. Like that, but that's like the truth of your life, is that, like, for the next group to flourish, the old group has to die, and you just have to, like, kind of wait it out. And hopefully, like, that your child has gotten enough from you to be good without getting the parts of you that are bad. Which, again, as a father, that's resonating with me even more now than it did when I was just a son. And this movie, It's a similar concept of, like, you know, everything you can do all that you can, but sometimes life is just going to hurt you anyway. And the only thing that you can do is, like, try or sit there and wonder, and it's just not going to work. Because throughout the entire end of the film, like, the moment that they go to knock on that door, I was like, all of these requests are exceedingly reasonable, and if anyone would give in to anyone, it might be fine. But it's the questions of, well, once they're gone and I can't control them anymore, what happens then? And that's what's scary.
Yep.
They don't, it's not, they never talk about, like, oh, well, what if they're all sick and they get us sick? They're like, what if they leave and come back with more people or more guns? Like, and that's what gets that family killed. Because there's enough distrust that if they were to, like, I feel like if they had said 3 weeks ago, or however long the movie is, but, like, way before any of this happened, like, right after the Chinese checkers night, like, we think we're going to go, we think we're going to try to make it on our own. Thank you for your help, but we are a burden. We don't want to be here. Can we have some food and water and leave? I think that they would have said sure. But after all that happened, after finding out that Will didn't actually have a brother and maybe misspoke or maybe lied, there was just no way that was ever going to get brought back. And so from that moment on, know it or not, you're a prisoner. You're a prisoner of your own lack of trust that you've instilled in someone else. And like I said, that's something that you don't usually see a lot in these movies, because usually it is the external thing, or it's greed, or it's, you know, hatred. But in this, it's just uncertainty and a desire for control, and not even in a dark way, not like blindness where that one group started demanding women for food. Like, these are all very basic, general, decent, practical things, but they spiral out of control because no one can trust anyone else.
Yeah, one wants water, and the other one wants a little bit more sustenance. Yeah, so they agree.
Beneficial.
Yeah.
And then it all goes to shit, because no matter what the other person has or what you think, like, if you can't trust, then there's nothing left. Mm-hmm. And you only have that first moment tied against a tree when someone is first talking to you to build the foundation that, you know, you're going to have for the rest of your life with them. Your short life. I feel like I've just wrapped up all my thoughts on this film. This podcast is now almost as long as this film. Does anyone have any final thoughts? Michael, did you want to jump?
Not really. Not really. If I'm being completely honest, not really.
Did anything we say in any way affect the way you thought about the movie, or do you feel like we're just building like a naked emperor suit?
It's more like it's the naked emperor suit. The thing I was thinking about is where Wile E. Coyote keeps hammering boards like over a chasm. And that's what it kind of feels like to me.
Okay. Well, that's weird, but okay. I've been there. I understand what you're going through. It's interesting to be on the other side of this, because I saw this movie and I was like, great, another podcast where we all agree. And then it's interesting, A, to find out, Mike, that you hated it so much, and then Bill, that you had a problem with the ending, but it was not the problem I thought it was going to be, and it actually was a lot more of an interesting problem than I thought.
I had a weird thing where I thought it was okay when I walked out, and then I started thinking about it more, and I was talking about it with my girlfriend, and I got really angry about it.
See, usually I don't have to get like worked into anger. Usually I know, like, the second I walk out, it's like, oh, it's going to be a screaming episode for Brian.
At first I'm like, oh no, it's pretty, it's well acted. But then I'm like thinking about it, and I'm just like, no, this is fucking snake oil.
Jesus. Yeah, I watched this with three other friends, and we got out of the film and we all had the same issue, and that was central to that fucking locked door and the dog. And it was like we all like hashed it out, and I came away from that experience and that conversation very much like, okay, that is my major issue. that's where I'm laying my stake.
I went and saw this with my wife and my brother, and I don't get to see movies with my brother often, so I'm always interested in what he thinks. And like, my wife is having a legitimate panic attack through a lot of this movie, and afterwards I was talking and my brother was like, you know, but like all this stuff, and he said, like, you know, it's funny because the second they put those gas masks on, like, to the other family they became monsters. And in addition to that, he said, you know, and what like, but they never figured out what happened to the dog. And I was like, yeah, because the smallest issue of just who touched whom when and who is sick, like, eclipsed what in like a Wes Craven film would have been like the entire plot, where it's like, now we have to find the dog throwing gang and they're going to murder us all one by one.
Yeah. Yeah. There's something outside.
Yeah. And I liked that.
Like, I don't necessarily agree with that little thing, but I'm not. I'm not doing it.
Bigger issues, Michael. Bigger issues.
Let's just move on and close out. So that
this is the hill I'm going to die on.
You've like decided not to die on the hill, though. Like, you watched us charge up there to meet you, and then you just kind of stood at the bottom and were like, you know what? No. And then walked away.
This and Colossal are the ones where like everybody's like, oh, it's some of the best movies of the year, and I'm just going to be the one just shaking my head quietly.
Michael, we know that people on Twitter are going to say that you hate every movie you see.
Oh, I know.
Would you like to name a movie from like the last 2 or 3 weeks that you've seen that you liked, just to preemptively stop them?
Wait, Wonder Woman. A movie, does it have to be a new one?
But he even had issues with Wonder Woman.
Well,
we
all had issues with Wonder Woman.
True.
Does it have to be a new movie?
I would prefer it if it was.
Oh, God, this year is giving me an existential crisis. Fine. I really, really liked, was that in the last couple weeks? I really liked Columbus, which I saw at the, Chicago Critics Festival. and that is my
film I've never even heard of.
It stars John Cho and Haley Lou Richardson from, Edge of 17.
That's a real critics move, Michael.
It's
all the stuff in theaters sucks. All the stuff you plebes can see. But if you can make your way to this cosmopolitan city to see this one film that will never be seen
at the film festival, that's only probably playing once.
You know, I liked The Lure. That was recent.
Yeah.
I like I can chill.
The lore is technically not recent though, because that film definitely came out like a year and a half ago.
Yeah, but not here. So like
well, you know.
And it's the widest, like, what was it, Bill, that you said, the widest of all releases because you can see it on Amazon. All right, so that's The Lore, currently on Amazon, and It Comes at Night, which is currently in theaters from A24 releasing, which still feels weird to say. That's our thoughts. Let us know what you thought by finding us on Twitter at Film Stage Show, Facebook, The Film Stage Show, and of course, emailing us podcast@thefilmstage.com. If you would like to argue with any of us about the quality of It Comes at Night in real time, all you got to do is go become a Patreon patron, and you will get access to a special Slack channel where you can talk to all of us hosts and other patrons. So remember, for as little as $1, you will be able to get access to that. That seems like it's it. So let's talk about Mubi real quick. Mubi, better than sunscreen. If you are a quick-burning misanthrope who doesn't want to go hang out on the beach that much, all you got to do is go to Mubi.com/filmstage, and you get a free 30-day trial, where Mubi and its curators will select one new film every week. Oh my god. Every month. No, why do I keep failing at this? Every day a new movie comes on Mubi and exists in their sphere for 30 days. So you have a constantly rotating selection of 30 movies to watch. Again, you can get a free trial of Mubi. All you have to do is go to mubi.com/filmstage for that free trial. Mubi, better than sunscreen. And again, patreon.com/thefilmstageshow. For as little as $1 per episode, you can help us to become a better show and to do more episodes. $50 an episode together from everyone who is doing stuff, and we will start talking about classic movies and onward from there. Not only that, but this week we have one of our special patron-only raffles, and that is Rumblefish, the Criterion Edition, which you can snatch from the jaws of Jordan Raup. So get on it.
Wait, Patreon. Literally from his teeth?
Yeah. If you're okay. In New York, he'll bring it to you in his mouth like a dog, and you can
maybe wash it.
It will be in a plastic bag. Okay. And then he will open the bag for you. Anyway, right. I'm glad that I'm continuing to degrade Jordan more and more as we go on. Anyway, so that's patreon.com/thefilmstageshow. Just remember, nothing is changing. You can only benefit from this. Don't freak out. If you have any questions, find us on Twitter and ask, and we will be happy to answer. And, that's about that. So, it's been an extra fun episode. Michael hated another movie. Bill and I harmoniously agreed, except for that one plot point, which, again, is a much more interesting complaint to have than one I thought you were going to have.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I was like, you said, like, I hated the end of this movie, and I was like, oh, everyone dies. And I was like, because just what I feel like most people's problem's going to be.
No, man, I will bat hard for The Mist. I will bat hard for The Mist.
There's nothing we agree on. That's a great movie. What was I going to say?
Yeah, it's great.
Bill.
Yes.
Do we need to explain to you why this is called It Comes at Night?
Although I think it would be fun if it was C-U-M.
Oh, Jesus. I'm glad that we saved the semen joke until the end of the podcast.
And I thought my dirty joke was bad.
Look, none of your dirty jokes are great. That's it for today. Let's tell the fine people at home where we can be found between now and the next time. Bill Graham.
You can find me on Twitter arguing with A24 about how they pronounce their name, making the little fighter emoji smiley thing at Cable BFG. You can also find me writing about movies on The Film Stage and FreshFiction.tv, and go Patreon. Woo!
Woo! All right, Michael Snydell.
You can find me on at Snydell, where I talk about all the things I like. Like Seinfeld. Seinfeld's pretty great.
I've been watching Frasier. That's pretty good too.
This is our first time through Seinfeld. We're on the sixth season. Oh, it's pretty amazing. And occasionally things I don't like, but then I also write things, like for instance, right now, you can go to the film stage and read my interview with the illustrious Steve James, who directed Abacus and, you know, like past classics like Hoop Dreams and The Interrupters. And I had a great talk with them. So go read that.
All right. Now for myself, you can find me on Twitter tweeting about stuff. I feel like I don't have a joke to make this time, so I'm just not going to make one. You can find me there at Brian J. Rowan. You can find me on Instagram at Brian J. Rowan. You can find me on Letterboxd at Brian J. Rowan. Are you picking up a theme? And you can read what I write over at thefilmstage.com, my personal site, dearfilm.net, where just as soon as I finish watching Leftovers, I'm probably going to write a 5,000-word treatise on grief and religion and all various things related to that show. Other than that, that's it for today. Hopefully this week we will be able to record a roundtable episode. That's it, guys. And then next weekend we're going to be talking about a movie, but we haven't decided what it is yet. So stick around, look us up on the social media, and we will be sure to give you a heads up.
Or give us some ideas.
No, you can't give us ideas unless you become a patron at patreon.com/filmstage. Anyway, thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Have a great day, and see you next time.